Welcome to episode 127 of the Omnigamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including POGs. I am Daniel Winter.
And I'm Mark Uessa. How's it going, Daniel?
Good. I do have to ask, I'm not sure if POGs is technically the correct term here in North America. Perhaps Tarzans?
POGs are a thing. I mean, they were featured in The Simpsons, so I think that definitely qualifies.
Yeah. Otherwise, I have been good. It's the calm before the storm of the holiday commitments coming up here. How have you been?
Yeah, thankfully I have no holiday parties to look forward to because my place of work is out of province, so I don't
I'm unemployed, so...
There you go. It's brilliant. I personally detest those forced social engagements, so I'm happy to be clear. Stuff is good. Just, you know, like lots of family drama comes with the territory of having two teens or preteens in the household. I recommend not doing it. It's not worth it.
Mine's not a teenager. She never will be, right? Like that'll
exactly.
Work. Yeah.
You're in that great window where you just have the right one that'll never be a teen. It's great.
Mm-hmm. It'll be perfect.
There you go.
Excellent. Well, I think we're going to try something a little bit different today. So for a few months now, we've been trying our new three-course format, where we split our topics between the appetizer, main, and dessert. And I think we've both largely been enjoying that format. I do think we want to tweak things up a little bit, largely in perhaps loosening up the main format. We still want to have games where we've both played and can discuss in detail, but where we're both playing different games, we perhaps want to just, like I said, loosen it up a bit, perhaps broaden out the definition so we can discuss a few different games. Perhaps, you know, give some more initial impressions or the opportunity to revisit some games rather than just each of us going deep into one particular game that the other hasn't played and then monologuing for 10 minutes. So we'll see how that goes. So it'll allow us some more flexibility week to week as to what the format's going to be exactly. But as we've said previously, I think we've both been struggling a little bit with getting those deep dives just with the nature of scheduling games lately.
Yeah, I'm hoping that this new, I guess, loosening of the format, still going to keep the three-course thing. What it's going to allow us to do is, I think it's remiss that we don't ever revisit games.
Mm.
So maybe, you know, like I'll play the first 10 hours, 20 hours of an RPG or something, and then as we continue with the weeks, I eventually end up finishing the game, and then we never get to talk about it again. So I'd like to revisit how I feel at the end of a game, and also maybe like just share thoughts about games. You know, like we mentioned that Shadow Hearts or whatever, what was it called?
Oh, Shadow Labyrinth.
Shadow Labyrinth. Like games that we've tried but just aren't worth. Maybe we'll want to warn our audience to avoid such titles that just weren't doing anything special.
I gave that one a good college try, but I ended up returning it to the library early. It just was not doing it for me.
Fair. I have a game that I played that I'll be covering a little bit later. So, yeah, we'll still be talking about, you know, a game that we've devoted a chunk of our week to, but we're not going to be constraining ourselves so tightly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll see how that goes, and please do let us know what you think of the format. So, with that said, shall we kick off with the appetizer?
Let's do it. Yeah. Do you want to start us off, or shall I?
You go ahead, Mark.
Sure. Okay. So, one piece of news that's not news is it's Black Friday week, and we're being bombarded in every direction if you're even somewhat online. And even if you're not, you're probably seeing paper flyers or seeing them advertised on billboards or definitely in store whenever you go out of the house.
Well, I was surprised to learn just today that it is not Thanksgiving weekend. I thought like this Friday last was Black Friday because there's Black Friday sales happening. Surely that's Black Friday. But no, it's Black Friday comes a week early now.
Yeah, it's a little strange because Black Friday used to be a day. It wasn't a week. And now it's multiple weeks. And we didn't even have Black Friday in Canada because we had this thing called Boxing Day.
That was
the
same in Australia.
Boxing Day is a week as well. So Black Friday is a thing because Black Friday is everywhere now. So, you know, as I get older and wiser, hopefully wiser, I tend to realize that the whole world is trying to get me to buy something. Everywhere in the world, you know, sometimes I don't even want to open up a web browser because everywhere I look, every email that comes in my inbox, every website that I visit, you know, I want to know news about the games industry and things like that. Everywhere I look, everything's trying to sell me something. And no more is that true than Black Friday sales when things come around. And I really tried, I honestly tried desperately this year to find something to just dump a load of money into, because that's what the world is telling me to do. And I tried hard trying to reason with myself, because I don't have unlimited funds. I'm trying to realize, what's the best deal? You know, what is the best allocation of my few meager dollars to get the most out of games? And then I slowly realized that there's nothing. There's literally nothing that I need to buy. So that was my big realization this year, despite the fact that there are considerably attractive options out there. There's like fairly big PS5 price cuts right now. Of course, this is only taking us back to before they raised the prices earlier this year. There's even a price cut on PlayStation Premium, the annual account that includes the cloud streaming. I can't really take advantage of that because I don't have a PS5. And I think I'm actually going to steer away from the PlayStation Portal, which I mentioned a few episodes ago. So I dodged a bullet there. And things are so uncertain now. People are already talking about PS5. People are definitely talking about Steam machines. We were just talking about that last episode. So right now seems a very uncertain time to invest in anything. So I realized that I don't need to buy anything. And that's what I did. I ended up not buying anything. That's not true. I bought a game or two for the family to, you know, open up at Christmas. But other than that, no, I managed to avoid it. How about
you? Put it in the Steam Machine Fund.
There you go. Although, yeah, I can't do that either. I can't promise myself, my current machine won't run it, but I'm buying it as an investment for the future. Can't do that either.
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid sales right now, catching up on my backlog still. I did pick up Castle Crashers Remastered on Switch, which I did own the original version on Xbox, but the backwards compatibility doesn't really work, especially for co-op. So my daughter was quite excited about that. We discussed that with guest Dennis recently. It holds up pretty well, I will say, but very, very spammy. It's quite tricky. It's more difficult than I recall, especially trying to like defend my daughter. But she's having fun for now.
I realize now, and this is a little bit of a depressing thought, but you know, as I reach middle age and later even, I realize that I have all the media I will ever be able to consume already for the rest of my life. Which is to say, I know I'm an avid user of the library. I love the library system. I think it's one of the one few holy good things in the world is the library. And I firmly believe in it. And I make use of it a great deal. I'll be touching on that a little bit later. And I own, through Steam purchases or just retro catalogs, a ton of old JRPGs. I know how slowly I get through them. I know I'll be 80 before I get through a lot of these titles. And there's so many books in my backlog, too, that I literally have every piece of media I need before the rest of my life. Which is not to say I'm not going to buy any things, but those things are just going to be slowing me down from completing my backlog. I'm not a religious backlog burner. Like, I don't feel compelled, like, I have to burn through my backlog. But people may have noticed I'm, you know, really interested in retro games these days, and I do feel a compulsion to maybe try out some of those titles that I missed in my journey, of game playing journey, some of these classics. So, you know, I don't feel really compelled to sign on to a new service. Even Nintendo Online Classics has so many titles that are just really quality titles that I don't need another service. I'm trying to tell myself that.
Yeah, I've been on a real retro tear lately. It's hard not to be a little bit cynical about the constant barrage of just, there's more games coming out every week than there was in the entirety of like the 90s, it feels like. But I mean, especially when studios are sort of rushing out these games with like AI slop and justifying all these corners that need to be cut. And it's like, well, just let things take the time. We'll be fine. We've got 100 games to play in the meantime. There's really no rush.
Yeah, AI slop and, you know, loot crates and just a lot of, you know, subscriptions and really kind of just dubious techniques is, you know, I think we mentioned it before, the games industry doesn't have to continue. We don't need an industry to have games. There's indie creators, there's cooperatives. We don't need these large publishers anymore in the age of the internet. We can have direct creator to purchaser games if we wanted the world to be that way. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I think the publishers are shooting themselves in the foot, and they're hurting a lot of developers who just want a paycheck along the way.
Absolutely. They're going to collapse a lot of jobs and economy in the meantime. So, yeah, we'll see there. Okay, so for my news, I mean, as we're recording, literally PAX Unplugged just wrapped today. I'm disappointed to not be there, having attended the last couple of years. Perhaps one day I'll get back there, we'll see. I was glad to see the Indie Night Market, speaking of indie games, seems to have been a success. I'm hoping to try and find someone who can perhaps talk to that a little more explicitly. But, you know, it looks like there was a huge turnout to that, which is great to see. But my topic for today I wanted to discuss is Mouse Ritter Month. We've previously discussed Mothership Month, which I think we discussed that last year, but that did reoccur this year, last month. And this year for November, they've introduced Mouse Ritter Month over on BackerKit. So Mouse Ritter, I mean, it's hard not to associate that game with Mothership. I mean, I bought them both at the same time. They both start with M. They're both somewhat OSR related, but it is quite a different product. I mean, Mark, are you at all familiar?
Yeah, it's kind of like, what's that story with the tiny mice?
Red Wall. It's a bunch of them. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like little mice are the heroes and they're fighting against giant cats and, like, you know, everything's mundane things like being on the inside of a kitchen or something is a giant adventure because of the scale.
Yes, that's really the thing that drew it to me, because like Red Wall itself, just playing as critters isn't quite enough whimsy. Like that doesn't quite tick enough boxes. But hearing that it was, you can treat it like sort of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, or what's that video game where you shrunk in the backyard? Sequel just came out. I'm blanking on it. But that sense of scale and awe and recontextualizing things, they're suddenly a lot bigger than we're used to seeing them. And like, what does a shovel look like when you're an inch tall, basically? So that's really fascinating, especially I saw some hints that you can play it in this sort of roadside picnic discovered technology, like left behind by a sort of a bygone race. Maybe the humans are all gone and it's a post-apocalypse and the critters are sort of re-implementing their technology in new ways. There's a hints of like magical fey weirdness, that's weirdness with a Y, of course, going on as well. So you can take this in a few different directions. You could just stick it to your sort of sword and board mice politicking if you really want to. So that is to say, I actually read through the book this last week. I actually picked up the sort of box set last year at PAX Unplugged. I finally got around to reading it, and it is really fascinating. It is definitely sort of the OSR, very much like roll up a character on the fly, very simple to generate new characters, new content. Even the sort of adventures are designed to be sort of rolled, but on a hex map, curiously, which I've messed with a little bit in Realms of Peril, campaign I've been playing that I'll talk about sometime soon. But it's more about exploration and also a lot of logistics too, surprisingly, like how far you can travel in a day without sleep or how many slots you can carry. There's a big sense of materiality, like the actual things you can carry having physical slots, and like you have like a board with interfaces and actual little like cardboard chips, like filling up slots on your board. So definitely a great sense of physicality, especially with the physical world playing such a huge role in sort of visualizing this game. So yeah, I'm quite curious to check that out and potentially play a game. I'm not sure that I'm quite ready to GM it. I don't know if my daughter's quite old enough to run it through it, but what I might do is just generate a hex map and like, as practice, to like run through the process of generating content, maybe a few random tables. Because the idea being that you basically generate adventures on this like this map. You might have three or four different adventure sites, and you'll generate different encounter tables for each of those sites. But the encounters, the adventure sites can also be somewhat randomized. Of course, if you could just do it random or make up your own, but there is also a huge selection of adventures. I mean, this game was designed to be basically a third-party plug-and-play sort of a sandbox modular system. There's only one adventure in that core box that I got called Honey in the Rafters. That's surprisingly, like, basically it gives you a setting and some like unique enemies. It doesn't give you any text or narrative. It'll give you like random unique tables to roll for, like, here's some hooks you could roll, but it's still up to you as GM to contextualize those hooks. You're not really given a wall of text to just deliver to your players. You still have to do some work there. But if just coming up with that unique setting and like a little map is the sticking point for you, those are great options. There are plenty of others, both official and unofficial adventures that will also go to various extents. There are some that are whole campaigns, not just individual adventures, but whole campaigns that are sort of tied into one larger setting. Looking through the Master of a Month campaigns, I've only dug through a few, but there was one there that's basically set in a theme park. I didn't write down the name, but it's basically like 9 adventures in and around a theme park, and I think it's like contextualized the nighttime of when the humans go home, the critters come out, and there's this whole other world of politicking and grand adventures going on. So lots of options there. One other note I did see in Mouse Read a Month was a local artist, Ed Ciamarco, has a campaign for Tales and Trinkets, which isn't so much an adventure, but like a whole new crafting system, just a supplement to add a new mechanic. And you can use the actual crafting itself, or you can just have a selection of new items that you could incorporate into your campaign. So yeah, it really is a very modular system, whether you just want individual adventures in a little brochure or like large sprawling adventures. It does seem like it's fairly easy to sort of customize depending on your experience as a GM and player. I did appreciate there were some really nice little tips in the book for how to GM, and some suggestions for how you can encourage your players basically and sort of lead them along. There was one particular phrase, what was it, that I really liked, just describing the act of role-playing in general: conversation flows until mechanics interrupt. I thought that was just a nice little poetic way of putting it. So yeah, I really enjoyed my read through of Mouse Reader. I'm discussing it in the appetizer because I haven't actually played it yet, obviously, but hoping to do that at some point soon.
Nice. Great to see that Mouse Reader is having such success. That and Mothership, which we played, you and I, a little while ago. We didn't cover in depth, but it's great to see that indie RPGs are taking more of the focus in the tabletop role-playing game space. I definitely love the variety of experiences you can have that are not your typical trad fantasy stuff that we've all done hundreds of times before.
And they don't have to be giant tome hardcover products either. You can just get like a little zine brochure, and it's a whole new adventure for you.
That's right. Just bring friends and imagination. Speaking of tabletop RPGs, I have a bit of quick news. I recently discovered this is that, what are they called? Free League Publishing, which produces quite a lot of cool stuff, like the, what is that one? The Kids on Bike style Tales from the Loop RPG, right, among others. Oh. Mutant Year Zero, a few other
Lord of the Rings. Released.
Yeah, that's right. I think Lord of the Rings is, I guess they do have one ring, fair share of licensed one. Mm.
Actually. Alien, actually.
Mm. Yeah, and that's what I wanted to talk about is the brand new Alien RPG Evolved Edition.
Oh.
This seems to be like a second edition, which surprised me because I don't think the previous edition is that old.
No.
So my interest was peaked. I just saw it on DriveThruRPG recently. I'm sure that there's print versions as well. But basically, from what I understand, it is compatible with previous releases, so that's good. It includes some interesting things. Life path character generation, which is kind of a staple in another sci-fi RPG that I'm somewhat familiar with, Traveler. Basically, you get to like roll and create a life before they got there, before they got to be a character at your table. What were they doing in the preceding decades of their life? Which is a really cool concept. Revised rules for health, stealth, and stress, which is very reminiscent of games like Mothership. We had some close experience with that recently. New iconic weapons, ships, and locations from the hit film Alien Romulus. So they have expanded that with the license material. Obviously, you can only do that when you have the license. Other expanded rules like zero gravity, miniature support, and expanded campaign play, a new campaign setting, and this was really interesting, a new robust solo mode. They call it the game, so you can play without a game mother, which is what they call Game Master in this system. So that's, you know, that's offering a lot. Like, usually solo modes are sold as separate products, but this includes it. So that's really interesting to see. That said, I haven't read it yet, so I don't know if it's worth the extra $30 Canadian or whatever for the PDF to read through that.
I'm trying to remember if Dragonbane was also freely, because I know that has a solo mode that I've been meaning to try. But yeah, no, I've heard great things about the Alien RPG. I mean, I do have Alien at home. It's called Mothership. I've said before, I almost prefer RPGs to not be officially IP licensed when you can sort of play in the sandbox of an IP without being restricted by that world. I mean, obviously, in any game, you can file the serial numbers off if you really want to and make it what you want.
Yeah, there's definitely two schools of thought, is if you want to go fully licensed or if you want to go the unlicensed method. I think both are valid and both work. Like, I really like the licensed books just as works of art. Like
coffee table books.
Exactly. Skim through the lush artwork generally, that are all, like, you know, studio approved and whatever. And just read. If you just, for instance, I really like the Modiphius Star Trek RPG books. If you just want to, like, read a whole bunch of Star Trek history, it's all right there, let alone the fact that they have RPG mechanics to them. So they're just, like, fun to have around. Yeah. I honestly would probably say it depends on your budget and your level of interest. If you want to just play, definitely just play Mothership. It's cheaper, its rules are lighter, and you get into the fun of it sooner. If you want a movie-specific experience with, you know, as accurate as possible, you know, like guns or grenades,
say the lions
from the movies as possible, then you're meeting specifically xenomorphs or something like that, then you definitely want to pick up the licensed version, because it'll have that rich licensed material with it.
Do you have a sense of how it plays in between, like, the sort of from the alien to the aliens sort of spectrum, or can it pull off both of those tones?
I wonder. I mean, I think I have a PDF of the original kicking around, but I haven't read through it fully enough. But I've read enough of Free League books to know that there's quality stuff there. Most of them use that, what is that, Year Zero engine, which is fairly straightforward. There's been slight variations on each, but it's their house system. And I believe this one uses that as well, so... Yeah, it all depends on your style. You know, if you want, like, light and fast, I definitely recommend something like Mothership instead. We picked up, like, that session that we played so quickly, right, with a lot of novice players.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the beauty about the OSR system specifically. It's just, hey, roll up your character, you're good to go. We'll figure it out on the fly.
Yeah, but some people want that verisimilitude. So,
oh, yeah. Like,
it depends on your
audience. If you want to plan out a perfect background for your character, then maybe this is a better option.
There you go. Or just want some good coffee table reading. All right. What do you think, Daniel? We've talked at length there. Shall we move into the main courses?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a lot of game talk there. But as for what we've actually been playing, we'll kick off the main course. Okay, well, we'll start off with the tabletop. And I hinted at in last episode that I've been playing the Pokemon TCG with my daughter. She's just developed Pokemon fever over the past few weeks. Kicked off of all things by those little, is it Bandai? I think the little model kits. They were basically Gundam, but Pokemon. Oh, yeah. No tools required. You just plug them together. We're buying one of those for one of her friends. She's like, I like that character, I want that. And suddenly she's hooked on the anime and, quoting Pokemon facts at me all day. So that's been fun, just to sort of live vicariously through her. My wife and I were both big Pokemon fans back in the day. I'd collected some of the cards. I seem to recall having a shiny Zapdos, and I have no idea what happened to it. Probably worth thousands of dollars right now, if I can dig it out of the old shed at some point. But I've never actually played the game before. So what I was really curious about is I've seen that there's this product called the Battle Academy. There's been like three versions of this over the years, as they've sort of refreshed it with slightly different characters every time. Always Pikachu, though, of course. But it's basically a tutorial mode for the game. And like everyone I've asked has said, oh, it's Magic the Gathering for babies, you'll be fine. But I just love the process of tutorialization in games. Even if I could just figure it out myself or just read a manual, I like how the game presents itself instead of guiding you through that process. It's something we've only seen a little bit in board games, like leader games like Root and Oath do that a bit. And this actually follows sort of their philosophy. And what it basically does is gives you a deck of cards, or each player a deck of cards that are pre-seeded. Like, they're not, you don't shuffle them. They are selected such that you draw the cards and they're designed to know exactly what you're going to draw. And it will tell you, okay, now you draw a card. Now you're going to play this card. Now you're going to do an energy card. And it will guide you through the first like 4 or 5 turns of the game, I think it was, which was pretty granular in that sense. What it didn't really do is describe why you're doing any particular thing, which was a little confusing. Like, it always says draw a card. It doesn't say, though, because you always draw a card at the start of your turn. So it didn't really... You have a broad sense of the framework of what a turn looks like. You won't understand the why of why you're doing a particular thing, but it will get you sort of in the similar... Like, it'll give you a broad understanding of what the big picture of a game will be, and you can figure out the rest from there. You will probably still need a slightly older person to read through the robust rules, and it does include that in the box as well to give you a better understanding as to what you're doing when. But it was a pretty seamless experience. My daughter's pretty hooked. She's won 3 out of 4 games, and that's me only like pulling a couple of punches, I will say. So it's pretty good. I think we'll discuss the game a little more detail. I think you and I are going to try and get some games in, and perhaps we could discuss the game more broadly. But I just thought it'd be worth bringing up that as the Battle Academy product as a tutorial experience. It gives you like 3 decks that you can play in the box, and a few tokens and a board and everything. So it's a solid little product. It's not necessarily going to, like, you can't give it to a 6-year-old and expect them to figure it out themselves. they're going to need a little bit of help. But the one thing I do really appreciate with the latest wave of Pokemon products is this rating system. Basically, every product they sell will have 1 to 3 Pokeballs, which is basically a rating of complexity, which is something that like Magic the Gathering has largely given up on in terms of onboarding players and understanding what you're in for, essentially. Like, there's very little sense of tutorialization in Magic unless you're playing the digital version. So I do appreciate that Pokemon is still putting in that effort to try and onboard new players and give a sense of like what you're getting in the box.
Yeah, I've played some TCG in the past, definitely when my oldest was younger and sort of into the collecting of it. Every young kid goes through that phase, for sure. This is a little premature to start talking about, but I have been interested in trying out the Pokemon TCG game for Game Boy Color, which is part of Nintendo Switch Online. So I may have tried it out. So if you're subscribed to that service, which I think even the basic service will include, you can play it now on a Nintendo Switch-based system. So that's what I did, and I will have more thoughts on it in a future episode.
How close is that to the physical card game? I mean, I'm curious how much the card game itself has evolved over, you know, 30 years, whether the rules have changed a lot, but perhaps we can save that for a future discussion.
Yeah, let's elaborate it on in a bit when I've had a chance to dig into it a bit.
Yeah, I'll have a look at it myself. I didn't realize that was on Nintendo Online. Excellent.
It's there right now. Go check it out. All right. I'm going to mention a title very quickly. It's going to be one of those titles that I played for a bit, didn't really grab me, but I just, as a warning to those out there in game land, maybe to avoid this one. This game is called The Legend of Legacy. With a name so generic as that, how could you not succeed? This is a video game, by the way. I played it on Nintendo Switch. I borrowed it from the library. This game apparently originally came out for the 3DS. So this is like a HD remaster sort of concept. And what's good about this is the art is quite lovely, but other than that, by the way, this is from developer Cattle Call, first I've ever heard of them, published by Furyu in Japan, Atlas in the US, and NIS in Europe. So, you know, like, they have the backing of Atlas and NIS, so, you know, that's pretty big kudos, I thought. They saw something in it. I don't see what they saw. This game apparently has had nothing but mixed reviews. It's very cute. it's easy to get into. It's a sort of like action RPG. I think it's an action RPG. Like it's very, very, very easy. I didn't have a lot of difficulty with it. It has a little bit of the quality of some of the Etrian Odyssey games we talked about, where part of your journey is like unlocking a map. So as you travel within an area, you're literally kind of uncovering a percentage of the map as you go, sort of fog of war style. And I thought, well, that's a pretty cool system. Like, unlike Etrian Odyssey, you don't have to do any, like, hand demarcation yourself.
Cool. It's sort of automated?
Exactly. Okay. It's kind of like, it's more like Power Wash Simulator, where it's counting down a percentage as you go organically. And basically, you don't earn money by collecting items or monsters dropping gold. You only earn money by selling maps.
Huh.
And you earn more money if it's a higher percentage. So yeah, conceptually, it's cool. Just mechanically, it's just really, really flat. Nothing interesting.
Not much depth to it.
Yeah, I was not compelled to keep playing it further. So this is a lovely looking, maybe it might be suitable for young audiences, like just getting started. But, you know, you could put them on more notable, simpler games like Final Fantasy I Remastered or something.
Well, with a forgettable name like that, what do you expect?
Exactly. Note that name, The Legend of Legacy HD Edition, and forget it right away because you don't want to play it.
Is it a series, or is it even part of a series? Is it a franchise that's popular in Japan?
It's somewhat related to this title, which I was also vaguely in my mind, called Alliance Alive. So I don't know if you've heard that,
seen
that
box kicking
around. Yeah, Alliance Alive, it's been around. I think it's even on PC. It's just one of those names that I pinned in my mind saying, I should check that out. And like maybe I'll give Alliance Alive a try, but this one, yeah, just didn't do it for me, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, just I wanted to wrap up some tabletop talk here, and we discussed using this opportunity to maybe revisit some games. One that I finished recently was Tidal Blades 2. I don't think there's even a number on it. I think it's called Tidal Blades Rise of the Unfolders or some other, you know, X of the Y name. I discussed this in detail a couple of episodes ago, but just wanted to follow up as a final thoughts here. This is the sort of campaign tactical storytelling game from Druid City Games and Tim and Ben Eisner. I largely still really enjoyed it. I followed it through solo. I was playing two-handed basically solo, which I don't think is the ideal way of playing this game. Both thematically and in the mechanics, I think it's a game that's built around this theme of sort of camaraderie that I think would come across better when you're actually playing with other people and discussing tactics and having more back and forth. And there's just also a lot of like overhead of rules, especially when every mission is like introducing new rules or changing up the broad strokes of what you're doing in such a way that it can be hard to internalize every little fringe case of the rules. I always find myself forgetting things. It isn't one where balance is overly like important, because largely you just the story and the broad strokes are becoming more important than a finely balanced game. I think it does leave me like, I do have a lot of appreciation for the difficulty in balancing a game like this. That's going to have like, by the time you get to the end of a campaign, characters can look vastly different in how they've built themselves. And so trying to balance that between multiple players and like the different factors that you're taking in is incredibly hard to playtest, I imagine. So I can appreciate that. There was like one mission at the end that I failed in a way that felt unfair, and a couple of others that felt a little too easy, but that's not really a huge issue. You can just sort of power through and get onto the next mission. And what I do really appreciate in this is that it was, you're always interacting with the game with new verbs. Like you're always doing new and different things each mission. You're recontextualizing the actions that you have in fun ways. And it is tricky because you're not like, it's not one of those games where you can figure out a strategy and master that strategy. You're always having to like reiterate and try new things and experiment. And it's always been new and different as you go. I was a little bit tired by the end, but mostly because I think I was just trying to power through it. Like I've got it set up on my table. I want to get it cleared away so I can play other games, and I've just been sort of marathoning through it in a way that's probably not particularly, like, not the best way of experiencing it. But it did end on a really strong note. It's like, the way it's reminiscent of, like, Warcraft 3. I mean, broadly, I think the structure, like, the sort of those campaign levels in Warcraft 3, like, sometimes you're, like, escorting characters across the map, or sometimes you're, like, defending a town. Like, it also used that core system, but, like, the strategy and tactics for one mission would be different from the next, right? So it's very similar to that. And the last mission here being this all-out, everyone's here, huge sense of scale, and it was slightly longer and a lot of moving parts, but a fun way of, a really fun sort of firework, like, cascade of all everything you've learned so far. And, like, this great sense of, like, everyone falling, like, all your allies are slowly falling one at a time, until if you can pace that just right, the moment where you can beat the game right as things are about to collapse, that's a great feeling. And this managed to pull it off, I think, in a really clever way. The writing was, like, there were some twists, there was some sentimentality that was felt a bit tropey, but I think was pretty well earned. It's a pretty well written game, especially by board game standards. It's definitely in the upper tier of board game writing I've encountered. It all feels very genuine, if not a little tropey. But yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was a nice little capper on the campaign. There is some bonus missions. I think I'm pretty burnt out by now, just playing too much in one go. So maybe I'll save that for another time. But yeah, I really did enjoy my time with Tidal Blades too.
That's cool. I still don't know how I feel about campaign-based board games. I feel like they are basically just trying to just... It's like that meme of the fighter jets and that character from Invincible trying to say, do you see what they're trying to achieve with just a fraction of our power? It's like trying to achieve a fraction of what TTRPGs can do with such ease in the storytelling. I guess it's because, ultimately, board games are not really about storytelling. They try to include it, but in very awkward ways most of the times.
Well, as someone who's had a lot of anxiety with role-playing in the past, like, this is exactly the sort of game I was looking for. And say, like, Mansions of Madness, that gave you the taste of role-playing without having to sort of improvise character expression and dialogue. And, like, this did a lot of that. Like, same as Mansions of Madness, I had, like, sliding tile puzzles as, like, this another fun little way of interacting and sort of abstracting some different verbs of how you're interacting with this world. And again, like, if the balance isn't entirely there, at the very least, what you're doing feels thematic. You can still build a sense of improvised storytelling with the actions that you're taking. And so that, I think, is like, a priority above being a sort of tightly balanced strategic experience.
Yeah, as long as the choices you make have some real impact, and you feel like the story is your own, not just going through the motions.
Yeah, I mean, there is what few choices you do have in this are largely going to be an illusion. There's not really a lot of choice to be had, but there is still a lot of expressivity within the characters and the abilities you're doing, which I think it does the job there.
Cool. All right, I'm going to discuss another game I've been playing. This is kind of like the game that's taking the bulk of my time, so I'll probably go on a little bit more about this. This game is a video game. I played it on Xbox Series X. It's called Miasma Chronicles, another game that I borrowed from the library. This one is by developer The Bearded Ladies, who I'd never heard before, publisher 505 Games. And well, this is a...
Sorry, yeah. The Bearded Ladies are developers of Mutant Year Zero, the video game.
Well, there you go.
And looking at the trailer for this, I could easily mistake it for one for the other. It looks very similar in design and aesthetic.
Yeah, I actually just learned this recently. I have played Mutant Year Zero, not the tabletop RPG of the same name, by Free League, who we mentioned earlier. Another... Omni Gamer crossover here. I play the PC, the video game / computer game, which is actually pretty interesting. I enjoyed the little time I played of that game, and I'll probably try and go back to it. But this one, Miasma Chronicles, is for PlayStation 5, Windows, and Xbox that I previously mentioned. This game came out in May of 2023, so not that old. And very much like Mutant Year Zero, this is a post-apocalyptic game, and it's a strategy with a lot of RPG qualities, actually. And it's set, unlike Mutant Year Zero, it's set in the United States, I think in Tennessee or something like that, somewhere in the American South. And apparently, the director or the Bearded Ladies wanted to make this game a little bit more accessible to global audiences, and I guess like tying it to a Swedish tabletop RPG with weird duck
people. Make it universal by setting it in America. Classic American.
Exactly. That's what the world expects you to see. I guess it's like the Hollywood effect. Yeah, so definitely there are pretty much the same people who worked on Mutant Year Zero Road to Eden, which is the full name of that video game. So this game is has a lot of like XCOM-like qualities to it. It's squad-based, it's sci-fi, it's got, you know, guns and grenades instead of sword and shield and magic and that sort of thing. So that appeals to me a great deal. I actually played a decent amount of XCOM, but I never really went hard into it. Like, I know a lot of quite devoted fans of XCOM are out there. I never really like totally fell head over heels for XCOM and needed like I need to get through all entries in that series. This game is decidedly a B-grade game. And I sort of knew that going in. Like, the box art is not that impressive. No one really talks about this game, but I just had to see, like, is this anything? Is there anything here? And, you know, from what I can tell on the internet, it has decent scores. It has, like, it's basically like a 7 or 8 out of 10 in most places you check. So there's something there, and I tend to agree. The kind of tight camera angle, the three-quarter perspective, reminds me a lot of other games, like some of the early Fallout games, or even, like, Dragon Age Origins. If you control it from that perspective, you can kind of call this, like, Fallout 2.5, say, before they made the full switch over to 3. What I like about this game is, unlike something like XCOM, like, the scale of it is smaller. This is not like the end of the world. The end of the world has already happened. This is mostly a story. It's very story-based. It's about these ultimately three characters, and perhaps it's more, but the main part is three characters, and these are named characters. Mm. They have backgrounds. They have relationships. They have personalities. These aren't just like squad leader A and mercenary B and sniper C.
Well, XCOM was largely about like making your own characters, like whether it's naming them after your friends or after X-Men or whatever. There was a lot of agency in how you would get attached to those characters.
I would argue that that's not really about characters. That's like you're attributing
that's wish fulfillment.
Qualities. It's attributing qualities to kind of randomly rolled pieces that are thrown at you, kind of like OSR.
I was just compared that,
compared to a more handcrafted character that you devote some time planning in. So, like, there's good reasons to have either. I'm not saying this is better than XCOM because it has story based characters, but this is the choice that they made, and the characters are there. They're not knocking it out of the park with the writing of this game.
One of them is Elvis. Like,
the main character is called Elvis. Okay. And his best buddy, a character who he calls a brother, is called Diggs. And Diggs is a kind of a robust, kind of barrel-shaped robot. And they eventually meet up with a third party member. They may be more in the future, but of what I played of it, there's only the three. The third character is kind of like this kind of sneaky sniper who I actually really like that character. She plays well. So this game is, like I said, is quite B grade. Like, Elvis is not anything to write home about or inspire. He actually reminds me like a JRPG hero. He's got this spiky orange hair. He's got a robotic arm. He's on a quest to find his mother, who is like a legendary hero and slash scientist. So, like, there's a lot of tropey stuff, you know, finding your parent was the core goal in Fallout 3.
Universal way of being invested in the character.
Yeah, exactly. The mayor of the town is an immortal head in a jar. This game is quite like irreverent in a very Fallout way. So it gave me a lot of Fallout vibes, and maybe that was intentional. Let's just say it's very post-apocalyptic. A lot of it takes place kind of in like bayou and jungle.
So like some giant mutant frogs. So it's definitely like quite reminiscent of Mutant Year Zero. as still as well.
Right. Yeah. The main enemy right now seems to be these frog type characters, although you run into humans as well. And then there's this ominous kind of group called the Founding Fathers, or the first family. That's what they're called. This is basically like America has fallen and they've been reclaimed by this faction called the First Family. And this reminds me of a lot of like post-apocalyptic Americana stories that I've read, which I kind of enjoy. But I go on to say that this gives me a lot of retro vibes, not just of games like Fallout, but other kind of like story-based tactical games. Like, do you remember the Commando series?
I'm familiar with it, not played.
For PC. There's a few examples that I can name. There's a game called, what is it called? Gorky 13, I think it is. Mm. Like, basically these games that are, like, a lot smaller in scope. They're not these big bombastic games like Age of Empires or StarCraft. But the scale of them are a lot tighter and based around like a smaller, kind of more relatable characters, which I tend to enjoy in a single player game. This is a single player game. There's no competitive RTS quality to it. It's all turn-based, by the way. I should have mentioned that earlier. But what I like about the combat of this game is that, well, first of all, let me just say that unlike XCOM, which basically like as you like zoom in to the map right away whenever you start a mission, it's very dual, right? There's like base and then mission, base, mission, base, mission. That's XCOM. This game is not like that at all. You do return to town, but you return to town whenever you want to. You don't have to. If you want to fulfill the next story mission, sure, go back to town. Resupply. But you can go back, you can even fast travel back to town whenever you want to. But you can just explore as well. And there's these semi-open world areas. And the areas are like big enough that they can have multiple prescribed combat encounters on each. It's not random encounters, but like a area might be large enough to have like three combat encounters in it. And like you can just like sneak by one group entirely and just to bypass the area, or you could just plow through the whole area and just defeat every group that ranges there. One cool thing is that each area seems to have one opposing force that's like way too high level for you to defeat. So
come back later.
That's really cool. It gives you a reason to come back. And the game is like pretty straightforward with its turn-based combat. It's just basically like two minor actions or one major action. So usually that's just combat and move and attack. But sometimes if you're dug well into a good position with cover, you can, even if you have a single shot weapon like a sniper rifle, you can just reload and attack, reload and attack. So it's fairly flexible that way.
Is there much sense of character customization, or like the town building? Or like, do you have much agency in how you build it out?
There is no town building from what I can tell, so that's not a focus of this game. But there is a distinct amount of character customization. Each character has their own like bespoke upgrade tree, which branches off in a range of directions. It's not like robust as like Path of Exile or something like that, but it's big enough. And it gives you enough direction. Every character can have two weapons loaded. Each of those weapons can have two upgrades attached. Each character can have like a miasma power, which basically acts as a personal, like kind of special elite magical effect. So I feel like the character development will be quite robust. So I really think that's a bonus going for this game. And I found that it was pretty ho-hum until they introduced the third-party character, and then that character has this really cool effect. I mentioned before that she's a sneaky sniper, and what she can do is she has like a silencer on her weapon, so she can, if she's hidden, you can traverse across the map in real time, because like I said, there's no separate battle maps. You're traversing the world and fighting on the same maps. You can spend an inordinate amount of time to set up your positions, and you could even like just stalk the enemies, and when they get far enough from the group, just take them out with a silent sniper. So you can mow down like half, 20%, a third, 30%, 50% of an enemy force before you have to engage in turn-based combat whatsoever.
I seem to recall
really cool.
Mutiny Zero having similar sort of stealth systems that you could set traps and things, and that getting pretty tedious with the amount of setup it was, especially with when the game... I think the reason I fell off of it was actually quite difficult, and I was save-scamming a lot and just got a bit tiring having to do the whole, like, setting up a... like, doing the recon and setting up for half an hour and then having it go bad and having to, and save-scamming again. Like, have you encountered that much of an issue here?
No, from what I've read, the team basically took their experience with Mutant Year Zero, and they apparently intentionally tuned that game quite hard, difficulty-wise. So I think they just scaled everything back.
Cool.
And what I did was I too did a lot of time setting up and a lot of time save scumming, but a lot of that was kind of like my personal like perfectionism. Mm. A lot of the time you could just roll with it, and I like how it is tactical, but it's not so prescriptive and so worn down in the minutia. Sometimes I'll just like go with the flow, and quite often in a lot of my combat encounters, it'll come down to like my last man versus their last man, which is kind of exciting, right? Like, I rarely do that in a game like Final Fantasy Tactics. If it's going really the wrong way, I usually don't like drag it out till the end, but this one, it flows fast enough. The combat is smooth enough that you can go with it, and like it has like very like good UI that previews your percentages for like how good your shot will go behind this.
I was going to ask,
cover.
How deterministic is the combat? So it's using like hit percentages?
That's right. It will give you like straight up percentage out of 100%. Mm. And if you're like right next to the guy, of course, it'll be 100%. But, you know, even if they have the slightest bit of cover, it'll take it down to 70%, 42% if you're a certain distance. So after that, it's just a roll of the dice, which as a tabletop game lover, I really enjoy. It's exciting and it's really free flowing. And I think it gives me kind of like the excitement of like tabletop RPG combat, but just way like 1,000 times faster just because it flows.
Because the upkeep's done for you.
Yeah, exactly. So suffice it to say, this game, a lot of things about it are not great. Like the tropey story, terrible voice acting. Especially the main character. The main two characters and then their sidekick, not great. Some of the characters, like their vendor, like some of the vendors are good. There's a lot of people of color in this game, which I really appreciate. I think the world building is only so-so, but the moment-to-moment gameplay is enjoyable enough that I'd like to keep playing it for a little bit. There's a lot of environmental storytelling as well, and a lot of secrets hidden in the world, a lot of loot you can find behind these sort of locked treasure rooms, which you can only unlock with secret codes that you have to puzzle through by finding quest logs, environmental puzzles. Sometimes the code will be like rendered in the terrain of the map rather than hidden in a quest log. So there are some aspects of this game which are quite clever and ingenious. And, you know, I really am fascinated by uneven games. You know, I don't want AAA. I want like single A, or in this case, a B+. I find those games much more fascinating than kind of the smooth over stuff that comes out of Ubisoft, for say.
Some of my best friends are 7 out of 10s.
Yeah, this game is squarely that.
I'm often find myself in the mood for one of those tactical XCOM likes. I do think I prefer the ones where you can. I like the whole XCOM style of like naming after your characters, or you know, crafting the base level. I like those how that interacts with the two different sort of versions of the game, like the characters base building back and forth. I'm overdue for one of those, I think. There was another one I was in my backlog called Shadow Gambit, The Cursed Crew, which was more in the sort of the Commandos line. I've heard very good things about
that. Oh, does that game have cards in it as well?
Not that I'm aware of.
Maybe I'm thinking of something else. Very cool. All right, that's all I have to say about Miasma Chronicles. I think it's worth it. I think it's worth checking out. But there's so many games that you'd more highly recommend, like the XCOM games, like Mutant Year Zero. This game is not totally hopeless, though. I enjoyed what I played.
Excellent. Yeah, I'll definitely take a look, especially if I can find it at the library. I had a few things queued up here. I think I'm going to save most of them for next week. So just in the interest of timeliness, I'm going to talk about the Octopath Traveler Zero demo, which came out this last week. I believe the full game is out December 4th, so just a couple of weeks away. I mean, this is obviously developed by Square Enix, which it's hard not to associate a bit of ick with these days. Obviously, this is a free demo that I tried, but Mark, you and I have talked about the Octopath Traveler series a little bit on and off. I mean, have you had any anticipation for this one?
I'm kind of tepid on it. Like, I've tried both Octopath Traveler 1 and 2. I think there's so many interesting choices going on in those games, and they look great. Whether you like 2D HD, I don't know, that's up to you. But none of them have really sunk their teeth into me because, like, I feel really disconnected to the fact that there's no order. All of the characters are not equally interesting. Basically, I would like more of a crafted flow, or I would like it wide open, right? Yeah. I don't want anything in between. I want either, you know, I want either, like, Morrowind, or I want Final Fantasy IX. You know, I don't want anything in between.
Yeah, I mean, I fell off the first one, heard that the second one was better in every way, and found that it was better in many ways, except that the pacing was still utterly broken. Like, you finally get out of the tutorial, things start to build up, and then grind to a halt and run through a whole new tutorial again, 8 times. And you can, like, delay that and run through them later, but the completionist in me has to know the characters, and it's really tough to maintain the pacing in those games. They are beautifully crafted. Like, the soundtrack keeps coming up on my playlist, and that was really strong. The combat system, I think, is still really good. I really enjoy that. Similar to the Bravely Default system, basically, where you bank up these sort of extra turns round by round, and you can sort of hold back or go hard, basically, once those have built up. And there's weaknesses and various things that you can sort of try and balance. So I think the timing and pacing of the combat is really strong. The storytelling leaves a bit to be desired. From what I've seen of the demo, I think it's like 3 hours that you can play for the demo. I mean, the pacing seems to be better here. Like, I don't have a sense of if it's still doing 8 characters. I've only have the one character. You basically make your own, and you run through their story. It's a pretty typical JRPG story so far.
I heard that it's 24 characters, so not 8, not Octo.
Okay.
And you sort of, like, recruit them over time, kind of like another JRPG where you recruit a lot of people, Suikoden series. So this is kind of like 1/4 of Suikoden, because you recruit 24 or so characters. Yeah, it's a real mix, and it's a lot to do with the fact that this is, like, a lot of redoing of stuff they did in the mobile game.
That's what I heard. Yeah, I've not played that. I don't recall the name, but it's not a remaster of the mobile game, but it's similar ideas, apparently. So basically, the character's childhood home is attacked and burned down, and then you're trying to, like, get the town back together, essentially. Like, everyone's scattered to the wind, and you're trying to like, find the people who survived and bring them back, or find new people, I guess. And so, like, town building in a larger, like, RPG is, like, a huge it scratches a huge itch for me, basically. Like, I love that fact of getting invested in a town and granularly building up and seeing it grow as part of a larger world. And that seems to be pretty strong here. It's a very granular town building. Like, it's on a grid, and you can individually decorate, like, around the town, like Stardew Valley or something, and you can assign people to different houses. You can play matchmaker, I guess, by dumping 2 people into 1 house, essentially. So that seems pretty good. And I'm assuming that the people that you recruit to the town are then you can then take out into battle. So maybe that's where they're getting that system from. It is slightly non-linear in that there's, like, 3 main villains, and you can choose which of the villains you want to go after. So I think that's where they're bringing in that sort of Octopath non-linearity. But it's not breaking the pacing and forcing you to go back through tutorials again. So there's that. The writing is a bit ho-hum. It's extremely saccharine and a bit like over, like just melodramatic. I think it's a bit much, the voice acting especially, and the villains are like just so exuberantly evil. I mean, I'd say it's not very realistic. Unfortunately, it's a little too realistic these days, but it's just a bit over the top, I feel. So I'm not buying that entirely, but the combat still good. The presentation's great. It's a pretty game, and I like building towns in an RPG.
Very nice. Yeah, I don't think it's going to be the first game I try to, but I'll try and continue playing Octopath 2. Unfortunately, I started it on Xbox, so maybe I'll borrow the game from the library. All right. So, in interest of time, I think we should probably move on to the dessert. If sure. It's okay, I'll start mine. Okay, so last time I think I covered a manga. This time I'm talking about another novel. And yes, it is Japanese-based. It is a Japanese novel translated into English. It's by Satoshi Yagizawa. And the name of the book is called Days at the Morisaki Bookshop. And this is a title that I think is fairly popular in English. I even saw it at in physical form at my local bookshop on Main Street. So it's around. And like the previous Japanese novel I read, I think it was the Baba Yaga one. This one is a short read as well. I think it's like 200 pages or something like that. Very, very fast. And it's a simple story. It's contemporary, mostly. And there's no science fiction, there's no fantasy in this. It's basically a contemporary story about a young woman living in Tokyo. And she, for various reasons, ends up living in a used bookstore run by her uncle, and in a region of Tokyo that's called Jimbocho, which is like the bookstore district. It's just a neighborhood of town that has dozens and dozens of bookstores, used and otherwise, because a bunch of publishing companies are established near there. Tokyo has a lot of these, like, this is the town for the thing. Like, this is the town that has musical instruments or kitchenwares or things like that. So Jimbocho is that. So she ends up staying there. And like that other Japanese book about books that I talked about, What You're Looking For Is at the Library. This is another story about kind of individuals that are like sort of lost, and they're yearning for something. They're searching for something in their life, and they find the answer in books. And this one does feature some real books. But they're not so prescriptive. They talk in detail about one or two books, but that's not really the point of it. It's mostly the individuals that are searching, that are yearning. And the overall themes are about kind of like finding yourself, and finding yourself after a long struggle through friends, family, and books. And I think this is a common theme in Japanese,
I'm seeing a lot of like media. Cozy Japanese books about cafes and bookshops and libraries. And it seems to be very much a. I mean, it's the same in the West. Obviously, it's very much a theme.
Yeah, I think it's because in like tumultuous times, which like I feel like Japan like is like living a little bit in the future. Some would argue that for a lot has argued that for a long time, but. Maybe not in the way that I'm alluding to, is like they're sort of ahead of the curve on a lot of like social phenomenon that are affecting the West. Maybe like just like 5 years ahead. Like Japan had a lot of issues with disaffected kind of like incel culture, like probably 5 or 10 years before it started its huge wave into North America with Gamergate and things like that, and various other things like disaffected youth through unemployment and economic struggles. And just kind of like social disconnection. And so maybe this meets people where they are right now. And it's in especially troubling times. So this book, I realized a lot of the books that are Japanese books that have been translated into English share a lot of qualities. They're short. The plots are uncomplicated. They have characters that have problems, and they have simple connections lead to kind of like profound realizations. And it's kind of a little bit like self-helpy. Like, it's not telling you what you should do. It's showing you, it's like parables. It's like this character found meaning and understanding self-realization through these simple steps. Maybe you could do it too by reading this at a cafe and having a lovely coffee or something like that. So it's very easy to digest. I think they're quite lovely because there's something like them. The structures and the form are quite poetic. You might like read a plot summary of the book and say, that's it. Like, what? That's not exciting. That's not dramatic. But I think that's entirely missing the point. It's about the simple form. It's about the structure, this kind of the metaphor, what's not said.
Sort of a meditative experience.
Yeah, but also something, let me just say, maybe this is an awkward analogy, but it's kind of like that other Japanese famous art form of the haiku, right? It doesn't have to be long. It's not epic poetry. It's short. It's simple. And it's a lot about what's not said than what's said. It's like sometimes you can say a lot with just a little. And that's what some of these books are like. Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree with this this philosophy I have, these similarities I'm finding. Maybe it's the Boss Baby effect. Everything looks like Boss Baby if you've only ever seen one movie called Boss Baby. So that could be it. But I enjoyed this book. And it has a sequel called More Days. That's Morisaki Books.
Yeah, I think that's the one I've seen. I mean, meaning to check it out. But I've gotten, there's a few variations of a theme in these Japanese books that I've gotten them a bit mixed up. But it's been on my list.
And maybe these are just the ones that are popular in English. Obviously, there's a whole range of novels that have not been translated into English.
It's also a point in that, like, what gets translated might be the more sort of easy to swallow pills and the cozy options, as opposed to the sort of, I mean, obviously, as you've discussed, there's sort of darker underbelly stories from Japan that have been translated as well. But in terms of what's popular in the West right now, it's probably it's not quite exoticism, but like I think there is a touch of something in that vein of being cozy, but it's a different flavor.
Yeah, exactly. It's the matcha latte, not the regular old latte.
Yes.
I will give this final this content warning about this book is that it does touch upon depression, and it talks about child loss. So if those are things that affect you inordinately, then maybe you might want to avoid that. But otherwise, great read, short read. Read it. Mm-hmm. Days at the Morisaki Bookshop.
Excellent. Well, I didn't really have a suggestion today. Mostly my wife and I have been watching more Columbo, to be honest, and still enjoying that. I mean, I don't have any additional thoughts compared to what I said last time. Columbo continues to show up like a serial killer or like a xenomorph and just surprise the villain of the episode constantly, which is always good fun. The other thing we watched was the new Frankenstein film from Guillermo del Toro, which I liked. I didn't love. It was a solid retelling of that story, but it did put me in mind of, I mean, I need to double back and actually read the story, the original Frankenstein story, which, I mean, many have purported to be the first sci-fi book, essentially. But what that did remind me of was another book that I read last year called Blood in the Machine by Brian Merchant, which is actually about the sort of Luddite uprising. And it was contextualized with, like, it happening at the same time as Mary Shelley and Blythe Percy Shelley, I want to say, the writer of Ozymandias. And basically,
Mary Shelley's husband.
Yes, yeah. And basically, they were writing at the same time as this little uprising, and he was suggesting that, like, Frankenstein is in part inspired by the sort of unregulated progress and technology, sort of progress above all else, and the sort of Dr. Frankenstein being the first tech bro, basically, in just sort of, well, I'm gonna move fast and break things, and who cares about the consequences, essentially. So I'm not sure, like, I can't say how much of that was intended. It is an interesting reading, and also that book, Blood in the Machine, was also just a really fascinating historical perspective on the Luddites, and, like, we use that as a prerogative. I think the Luddites were, like, fascinating, and we need more of them, so...
A lot of these derogatory terms, like Luddite, Ludd was a person that the movement.
Well, not a real person, a sort of
like a character.
Yeah, it was very much like I am King Ludd. No, I am King Ludd. Like this sort of fake person that was the blame, a sort of fictional scapegoat that the Luddites would sort of prop up.
Right, is that someone who will like break the machines in order to protest the loss of jobs and things like that. Yeah, which I am for as well. But the term, did you know that the term redneck, which is used to derogatorily refer to kind of uneducated, maybe people, particularly in the American South, apparently has to do with a worker movement, a strike movement against, I think it was to do with miners who used to wear like red scarves around their necks. So they were called rednecks because this was their sort of like uniform for their particular brand of worker action. So if you will call a person a redneck, maybe that's not the insult you're actually looking for. These are, of course, it's people in the establishment that have power, industrialists, that want to deride these people who are actually fighting for their rights.
Yep, and they're basically trying to co-opt, working class identities and turn it into an insult against, working people against each other, essentially. Yep. I think both terms should be reclaimed.
Or there's a third one, jaywalkers. Jay is an old term that kind of means like a fool. And a jaywalker is someone that foolishly walks into the street getting themselves killed by cars that just happen to peacefully drive by. Of course, it's the pedestrians' fault that they get killed, not the cars. This is an auto industry thing. But
there's no reclaiming bogan, though.
I don't know that one that well.
It's the Australian equivalent of redneck, essentially.
Very cool.
I can't talk to the right, etymology, so though.
Etymology minute, another segment that we're adding to the Omnigamers podcast. We'll see about that. All right, I'm pretty good, Daniel. What do you think?
Yep, I think we'll close it out there. If you have any thoughts on today's games or on the new format and how that's working out, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
Yeah, and check out our videos on YouTube. We post videos of each new episode that we produce. And if you want to check out our earlier oeuvre, our earliest episodes, you can catch them in audio form on a podcatcher of your choosing. Leave us a comment and like or subscribe on any of those platforms because that inspires us to keep going. We don't charge anything for this thing. So that inspires us, and we really appreciate it. Tell a friend.
Yes. Please do. Been thinking a lot lately about Blue Sky and the difficulty in reaching out and finding new audiences there. I'm missing the old days of social media, and it's hard to say whether we can go back, but we do appreciate like podcasts survive on word of mouth, essentially. So, yep, please tell a friend.
We need to bring Street Pass back on the Nintendo DS. We need to make that happen. Apparently, you can get Miyamoto's Street Pass if you bring like a DS to the Nintendo Museum.
Oh.
I totally didn't know that. I could have gotten it. I failed.
Apparently they just closed a 3DS tour mode at the Louvre.
Yes, the little 3DS guide that helps
you. That was still going apparently until like last month.
Yep. I think it's because they ran out of the hardware.
Mm.
Like they couldn't easily replace it anymore. Just sad to see.
Bygone times. Anyway, you can find me at Blue Sky at Board Game Feast and the Omnigamers Club account there as well.
Yep, you can find me on Blue Sky as well, MarkYuasa.
Excellent. And remember, everyone, to have a balanced diet of gaming. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.